find such a love at our age? Whoever thought we could dance on a thrill?
Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmers.
Well, hello, Judy, and hello, viewers and listeners. Judy, tell folks the title of today's episode.
177 Lovers and Counting, an interview with sexual anthropologist Dr. Leanna Wolf.
And she's just a fascinating person. We've just done that interview, and we'll show it to you in a little while after we've done our little bit of intro here. Before we go any further, I want to mention to folks that regular listeners and viewers of our podcast may have noticed that we have changed our intro music.
That's right, we have.
We have. So the music we were using before, which we're still, by the way, at the tail end, there's a snippet from that piece. Mm-hmm. It's a piece that I wrote called Besamim, meaning spices, that I wrote 25 years ago or so.
Yeah, at least.
And but we changed our intro to a song that you and I wrote and performed a little demo of. So it's a snippet from that called Since I Met You. Mm-hmm. So if you like that song, you can go to Bandcamp. If you look for, I think that's under my name, Bruce Chalmers at Bandcamp.
Yeah.
You can find that song.
Is it on YouTube also?
It is also on YouTube, yep. So, you know, look around for it. It's called Since I Met You. And if you, Since I Met You, and put, you know, Judy Alexander and Bruce Chalmers, you will find it. So before we got into our interview, let's put in a plug for our books.
Okay, let's do that.
Yes, starting with?
Starting with the book that started it all, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
And here's why you should buy that book. This is what I've been telling people.
Okay.
You should buy that book because it will help you feel better. That's what people keep telling me. I keep getting this sort of particular bit, you know, I'm abstracting a lot of different responses, but what people keep telling me is there's something about this book that just makes you feel better.
Yes, it does.
Feel better about relationships you're having difficulty with, feel better about relationships that you're happy about. You know, it's just, I think it's a very thoughtful book.
Mm-hmm.
Get it anywhere books are available. A more recent book that I also wrote is...
It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy is Wrong.
Yeah, and you get that book especially if, first of all, if you're intrigued about the title, that'll grab you. If you're intrigued about the title, you're going to like the book because it's like, wow, that's kind of weird. I thought it was about communication. If that sort of thought stimulates you, then by golly, get that book. And the other thing about that book is if you want to sort of look under the hood and see what the heck is... How does a particular couple therapist, namely me, think about how to do this work?
Right.
I go into a lot of detail in there about just how I think about how to do this work and how you as a consumer, perhaps, of couples therapy might want to think about approaching the work.
Right.
So if you're into that sort of stuff, that's a good book for that. And as we have been putting it, a word from our sponsor, which is...
The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
Yes, Laria Zilber, yes, who is a mysterious and interesting woman, Laria Zilber. I've actually had a chance to meet her. I've never met her together with you, but
no.
I've met her. Yeah.
Yes, you have.
Perhaps you could enlighten people as to why I've never met her together with you exactly.
Oh, well, because we're never in the same place at the same time. Actually, we're always in the same place at the same time.
That's right.
Yes, I happen to be Laria Zilber.
You see, we are, as people will know, and of course, as you'll see in this upcoming, in our upcoming interview, the subject of polyamory does come up.
Mm-hmm.
The closest I've ever come to polyamory is my involvement with both Laria and you. Which I'm happy to say is about as close as I want to be to polyamory, but it's sort of exciting. What
keeps
can I tell you?
Keeps things spicy.
Keeps things spicy, yes. Good old Laria. Anyway.
Speaking of spicy, why don't we get on with our interview with Leanna?
Let us get on with Leanna, yes, Leanna Wolf. Mm-hmm. And we will see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Leanna Wolf. Dr. Wolf's sex research was inspired by coming of age in the thick of the 1970s sexual revolution and feminist movement in the San Francisco Bay Area. Her curiosity led her to engage in field research in Mexico, Africa, India, and Papua New Guinea, earning an MA in anthropology from the New School for Social Research and a PhD in sexology from the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality. From 1980 to 2018, she worked as a university professor, teaching and researching topics ranging from orgasm, multiple partner sexualities, and sexual assault. In 2016, she launched Wise Woman Sex and Relationship Consulting, providing counseling through her unique lens of sexual anthropology. Dr. Wolf's recent book is 177 Lovers and Counting, My Life as a Sex Researcher, which she describes as an autoethnography wherein my story was positioned through the lenses of anthropology, politics, history, and sexology. Liana, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you. A pleasure.
We are so happy to have you.
We're delighted to have you. So we always like to start off by asking our guests, how did you get into the work that you do? You know, tell us something about your own journey.
Okay. Well, I was a shy young woman, and I was curious about sex, but I didn't really know how to find out too much. So I watched. So I'd watch young lovers or partners cuddle and make out with each other on park benches, and I'd kind of squirm a little and my heartbeat would raise a little bit. And then at some point I found my way to the library stacks in my local public library. This was like this mid-1960s, and I happened upon some of the books of Oscar Lewis, who was an anthropologist who studied largely Mexican peasants. And he went into quite a bit of detail about how the women especially managed their bodies and managed their sexualities. And somehow reading these things helped me figure a little more out. And then even when it was sort of the time, at least amongst many of my friends, to experimenting with sex, I was really cautious because I wanted a good start. And so I really waited, at least in terms of my time and my generation, a long time. It wasn't until I was 20 that I was sure that I was willing and interested in having intercourse with my boyfriend. And I think all that waiting also gave me, because the whole time I was gathering information and trying to figure things out and asking people questions and watching and everything I could to learn as much as I could, certainly safely. And then, you know, right after I'd had my first experience of penile-vaginal intercourse, I certainly didn't experience an orgasm. In fact, I don't think I'd ever experienced an orgasm. And I was determined to figure out how orgasm worked. And this was like the thick of second wave feminism, where there were articles like The Myth of the Vaginal Orgasm, and Cher Hite was publishing books on female sexuality that contended that 70% of women don't experience orgasm through intercourse alone. And so I really wanted to understand what this was. So I was in one of the many feminist women's consciousness raising groups, where it was basically a group of young women who would get together and talk about sex and relationships and their bodies and a bit about politics, but a lot of it was quite personal. And I started asking, well, you know, how do you experience orgasm? You know, anybody had it? And somebody in the group said, well, you know, one way that I think it'll work is if you get in your bathtub and run a stream of water and put your crotch right under the bathtub spigot and just relax into that stream of water and placing your crotch there. And it worked for me. And I was astounded. And so the first thing I did was tell my boyfriend he had to watch it and see what my body could do.
Wow. Sounds like you were an anthropologist even before you knew you were an
Oh,
anthropologist.
absolutely.
You have the soul
Yeah,
of a
I
researcher. It's
have that
amazing.
anthropologist personality of being willing to be a spectator as well as be a participant observer.
So how did your boyfriend react to this?
He probably thought it was a little goofy, but we never figured out how to have intercourse through, I mean, have orgasm with intercourse. It was a conundrum. I just didn't really get it at that time. And yeah, I don't think many young people in our society do. I did do reading about other cultures, because of course, being an anthropologist, I have to read widely. And I did find out in some of the South Pacific islands, like Mangaia, there's a practice of the older folks initiating the adolescents and showing them what their bodies can do. And orgasm is so expected amongst young folks because everybody knows the techniques and how, or at least their understanding of the techniques. And so if a girl doesn't experience orgasm with her boyfriend, she lets the community know and they shame him for not doing it right.
He's got to go back to school and
Yeah, he needs more training, and it's just an expected thing where we live in this blurry world where we largely tell our adolescents, especially our males, to channel their erotic energy into sports and not into sex. And we don't give them practical information about the clitoris or the clitoral system or anything about even being able to really extend and enjoy orgasm themselves.
That's so true. That is so true. So how did you get on after the first boyfriend? What was the next part of your journey?
Well, one of the things that was going on was I was living in feminist Berkeley in the late 60s, into the early 70s. And all the guys that I knew there were very concerned with not being called male chauvinists. And so they were largely respectful and not particularly seductive or romantic. And I knew that there was more to the male-female dynamic than just being kind of even. And so when I graduated from Berkeley, I decided, since I somehow had a little trove of cash because I'd gotten a few scholarships and grants and was extremely thrifty because I was raised by these Depression era parents. So I ended
Me
up
too.
with the grand sum of $3,000 in 1975. And so the thought of getting a job was ridiculous because I might as well travel and do field research in Mexico. So I went down thinking I would live in little villages like some of my professors had and do field research. And one of the things I hadn't exactly planned on, but certainly hit me very hard, was that a lot of the Mexican guys I was meeting were interested in dating me. And I was like all of 22, a really cute looking gringa. And I was, unlike the Mexican girls of the time, I was very unsupervised. Nobody was gonna come along on my dates and chaperone me. So these guys basically saw me as bait, and I saw them as this grand opportunity to experience seduction and experience like sort of the whole machismo that I had no previous access to. And so that became the next round of sexual anthropology field research, was having dates and stayovers and adventures with Mexican men. And
That's so interesting because you grew up in a culture, it sounds like, in terms of masculinity, of what we're doing to our men now. And that wasn't a turn on for you. And now we're saying all the things about men. Oh, you shouldn't suit do this. You shouldn't hang on corners and whistle at girls. But it sounds like that was the attraction for you, that you were missing that element
yeah,
in
and
your
I think
voice.
that's a big problem today.
Yeah.
I have a counseling practice. I think you all do
I
as
do,
well.
yeah.
Bruce does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have had a number of young men come in wanting to find girlfriends and having the hardest time because they've been basically socialized to not be assertive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and
And
young men don't know how, young men are afraid of women
yeah,
in the
right.
guise of respect. And of course, respect obviously is important, and yet they don't know. And I hear it from women all the time. Women are saying, I want this guy to be a guy, and he just
Right.
doesn't seem to know how to do it.
Right. And so there was this appetite that I had for being led and for being submissive that was very and counter to what feminist women were supposed to be like because there was a really limited lens of what ge how gender could be expressed.
Yeah.
And we're in it all over again, following Me Too. And I ended up, much more recently doing research on the impact of Me Too on gender dynamics because it's really challenging because we have and what I found, and this was basically a project I initiated in the fall of 2016, which was Changing Perspectives on Sexual Assault, where I started looking at the differences between how males and females and how millennials and boomers were engaging notions of consent. And so this whole idea that's been engaged a lot in mass media about no means no really means different things to different folks.
Yes, it does. Yeah, and also
So,
the absence of yes means no, which is, and it gets really tricky because it's practically, it's certainly my, it's not a direct impression because I'm not on college campuses anymore these days, but you were, it sounds like.
many
And that
years.
phenomenon, it's almost like you need to sign a contract before you suggest that you do anything sexual with someone.
Right.
Yeah.
And how do you know? Because certainly when, the way I came up was I was basically told that I had to say no, that I couldn't be immediately interested in being touched and engaged and turned on. And so there was a seduction dance, and I came to expect that dance. And so, of course, initially I would say some kind of no that I would pretty much expect if the guy could read me and play me and whatever, we'd get to a maybe and eventually a yes. But for me to be able to say a hell yes from the get-go was really difficult because I just wasn't wired that way. And I'm not sure many women are.
Yeah, it's so interesting that I've noted over the years, over the decades that I've been doing this work, and I don't know if I'm projecting this or really experiencing it or just hoping to experience it, but it's almost like we're able to have better conversations about gender roles and differences between men and women in general than we were able to shortly after second wave feminism in the 70s. That it's like, okay, because I keep hearing this stuff from women, women who will say, I want him to stop being so nice to me and just, well,
Take me.
yeah, just take me. Yeah. I'm trying to say what's our language? We haven't ever quite figured out exactly what our language code is here,
Yeah.
but basically what they'll say to these, I just want them to fuck me,
Yeah.
Right,
have at
right.
it, because that's a turn on. And yet
Sure.
to that for so long wasn't admissible in the conversation. The women saying that weren't allowed to think that even. And God forbid they should say that to a man, or God forbid that a man should be thinking that. And so it seems like things are, it's become more more part of the conversation, at least now, I think. At least I hope so.
Yeah, and I certainly think with the growing interest and awareness of kink, we're having more of these kinds of conversations where folks can openly admit they like, certain practices or certain styles that are other than vanilla, and to have very specific conversations about what it is they want.
Okay, so you're in Mexico, you meet all these macho guys, and you learn the game of seduction, and I'm sure that was very seductive.
Yeah. And
So
then what also happened, which I ultimately shifted my career interests eventually, was I got raped. And I was and it reeked of all the cross-cultural problems that I was engaging, because I was basically doing something that all the rape myth people would have said I was asking for it.
I can see why that would play into, yeah, that the absence of that sense of consent, if that isn't clarified,
Yeah,
then
because
of course,
basically I
yeah.
accepted a boat ride from somebody who agreed not to charge me, and I was on the beach and wearing nothing but a bikini, and I was by myself. And standard behavior is if you're 22, you do not jump into a boat with a stranger wearing a bikini. But I basically figured everything else had worked out okay. Why shouldn't this? And it didn't. And also because it was a time way before cell phones or anything like that, I was taken to some remote spot, and I had to go back into the boat with him, and I couldn't just stay there because nobody would ever find me.
And even
So
that act itself might well have been interpreted as, oh, see, she really, it really was consensual. Because look, she got back in the boat with me, even though you had no other choice.
So, what basically my assessment in terms of culture and the whole world of sex and violence at the time was that I'd better not talk about this. There was no way I could press charges. I was in a foreign country. Nobody, I didn't know who this person was. It was just like I left that area as fast as I could, and basically just stuffed it. And also my sense was, is if I want to be a professor and a writer and a professional woman, the last thing I want attached to my name was rape victim. And because it is like, if you came out publicly as a rape victim, that's all you were. And I didn't want that. So I just basically assessed that the best thing to do was not to talk about it. And it wasn't until Me Too emerged that, and I decided to do this research on changing perspectives on sexual assault, largely because of the Harvey Weinstein thing, the Donald Trump stuff, the kid at Stanford University. All of that was just exploding, and I knew things were changing. And so when I started presenting the findings of my research, which were largely, as I mentioned before, about gender differences and about generation differences, I decided to come out as a member of the Me Too movement, and I was like embraced. There was like it was it th things had shifted,
It's
and
so
it
interesting, isn't
all.
it, that the phenomenon you were saying before, that before Me Too, if you came out as a rape victim, that's all you were. And that was, of course, that impression was reinforced by the fact that so few people would do it for that reason. And Me Too made it possible, right? Is that an
Exactly,
experience of it?
exactly. So I could come out at that, write a book, have the book cover many different things, including that, and that would not be, it would not be considered a rape victim's book.
Yes.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I know that after that whole thing happened, like me and a bunch of girlfriends that we had never talked about before, like who'd been raped, who had abortions. I mean, that had never come up until the Me Too. So that I think that was an important milestone.
So continuing on with my sex research. So after I returned from Mexico, I found my way to grad school in New York City. And one of the people that I was dating was somebody who had just finished his doctorate in anthropology. And he and we had a really potent connection, and but I had basically experienced largely very vanilla sex, and that was all fine. And without even naming it, because I didn't know it had a name, he started doing some version of BDSM with me. And I really liked it. I like being pinned down. I like being slapped on the butt. I like the energy exchange. But at the same time, he wasn't somebody who was interested in a day in, day out relationship. And I ended up finding a different boyfriend who I had a really solid connection with, but I continued to live with one and see the other. And so we were practicing some version of polyamory way before polyamory had was named in the Western world, though, certainly it was part of what was sort of known as open relationships.
So, and so your boyfriend knew about this.
Oh yeah,
They,
it's like
yeah, it
every
was,
Wednesday night I went to see the other guy, and then I'd come home at midnight or something, and that would, and then we'd continue on with our lives, and then the next Wednesday I'd see him again.
Now,
And
was your boyfriend also engaging with other women, or
yeah,
he?
he did. We yeah, it was agreed that we could do other, and but it's like we, I mean, the main memory I have of whatever he did at the time was he used to collect poetry and put them in little booklets and sell these poetry collections on the streets of Manhattan. And he, at one point, he met a couple who invited him over, and apparently they'd had a threesome when he visited them. And so I was kind of envious that I didn't get to go. So, but that was about it. But we gave each other a lot of license to, meet other people and find our ways into adventures with other people. And so, and that was just kind of, but what I recall was that it was, but for any, and it was standard for many of the folks we knew. We were all in our 20s and maybe early 30s. But the moment somebody decided to get married, then it all stopped.
Interesting.
Well, so something about what marriage entailed, it just implicitly meant you weren't going to be polyamorous anymore. Is that?
Right. Yeah. In terms of, because there wasn't the notion of having an open marriage. It was just, basically, some version of being a couple, but not so committed that you couldn't have other partners or date other people or have adventures. And it did, and it's so interesting because all these things that we were doing have such specific names for them now.
Well, we were just hearing about that. Last week we interviewed somebody, or a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed somebody who is all about that. She's in a polyamorous relationship herself and
Councils
counsels
polyamorous.
polyamorous groups or
Right,
folks.
and there's like a whole wave of nomenclature that we at that time didn't really have to describe all these things. We were just doing what we were doing and processing or not processing it, however it was. And then, eventually I did do a dissertation on polyamory and jealousy. But that came out of a whole other phase of my life when I had found my way to Los Angeles. And at some point, I got involved with somebody who became a home partner, and he had a daughter, and we were raising his daughter. And then, about 4 years into that relationship, he got involved with another woman, believing that I was seeing somebody, even though I wasn't. But nonetheless, she didn't really know much about polyamory or open relationships. She just believed that he was jump-starting getting into a monogamous relationship with her by engaging her before he broke up with me. But he was determined that that wouldn't be the case. And I consulted some people who were engaging in polyamory then, and that was the early 90s, about what you're supposed to do. And their prescriptions and analyses seemed so limited from what we were going through that I decided I'd go to Africa, being an anthropologist,
There you
and
go.
find out how folks who had been doing this for many generations were handling bringing in another woman into what had begun as a monogamous partnership. And so I lived in villages. I interviewed every safari guide. Everybody who had a story helped me out. And I was in a very unique position because I was coming for counsel. I was saying my partner, my husband, so to speak, had gotten involved with another woman. How do I manage this? And I got some really interesting advice. And it was, very much from an African perspective. They would say, well, let's consider this. You live in a country where you have the right to get divorced. You have education, you have a job. You don't need to stay married to him to be okay. We're not in that situation. If we leave our husbands, we have nothing. We have, our identity is shot. Our families won't take us back. They won't pay a second bride price for us to marry again. We have to stay with these men. And so they just thought that my choice to stay was really not based on the practicalities that they were referring to in terms of why they stayed.
It's interesting that given the fact that you had the option that they didn't have, they weren't in a position to be able to consider, okay, even if you had the option, would there be sometimes reasons to stay? You know, might you be able to work that out and be okay with it? And of course, that's what you were trying to do.
And I did see that there was at times a sisterhood amongst co-wives, where they did help each other with children and with managing their husband. And one of the things that I was so excited about was that they had invited me to bathe with them at the river or at the lake. It was on the edge of Lake Victoria in Kenya. And so we were at the lake, and they were pouring water over me, and I was just like, oh my God, I'm like finally in this moment of really, ex being part of the kinship of women. And then suddenly a canoe full of the men of the village come by, even though they told me it was secluded. But the guys had heard I was bathing, and they wanted to see what a naked white woman looked like.
Crazy.
You know, it's funny, as you're describing this, Judy and I do a presentation on called Jewish Perspectives on Sex. And one of the stories that comes up that we always tell as part of that is the Rav Kahana story in not the Rav Kahana story before that, the biblical section that specifies if a man takes another wife, he can't deprive his existing wife of her conjugal rights. In other words, it specifies the her entitlement to continue to
Absolutely.
have that. And
Yeah.
it's interesting how that, you know, that
Yeah.
fits in
And
with other
that's
cultures.
very parallel to what goes on in traditional polygamy in Africa. And, you know, one of the other things that was happening at that time was that Bill Clinton was discovered to be having the affair with Monica Lewinsky. This was like 1998. And the folks there all had opinions about it. And they basically said, you know, he's the American president. He does not have a son. This girl looks like she's fertile and she could produce him a son. Hillary looks like she's old and probably can't have more children. He should be allowed to ha marry her and have a son.
Interesting. Wow.
And they, you know, it was a very practical thing about, you know, the legacy for a man. That he should have sons, and that this man was being, you know, had found a perfectly nice girl. Why wouldn't he be allowed to, you know, have children with her?
Well.
Wow. So, and what were some of the other cultures that you had learned from or
Oh,
studied?
I managed to find my way to Papua New Guinea. And I, you know, some of it was that. It was one of the more exotic places I'd ever read about or
I'm thinking Margaret
taught
Mead, right?
about. What?
Margaret Mead was
Yeah,
all
she
there too.
was in, well, she was in Samoa, but also there. So the Papua New Guinea, you know, is known for having some really unique cultural practices and beliefs because of the highlands being so difficult to negotiate, people would live in very isolated villages and generate cultural practices that were not found anywhere else. So there were practices like eating the brains of the dead, and the which ultimately for the villages who did this led to kuru, which is a prion disease like mad cow, where somebody would get afflicted and because of this practice. And there were so the one of the main things that I was witness to there, because I was trying to understand how they practice polygamy, was the men slept in men's houses and the women slept in houses with their children, and sometimes co-wives would share a house. And the beliefs behind this all had to do with beliefs in pollution, where men believed that menstrual blood was debilitating and that they were best to not associate too much with women because they could be impacted by their menstrual blood. And women believed that nocturnal emissions or any additional sperm around was very potent and could disable them. So the only way to stay safe was to live separately. And then I started saying, well, but you do reproduce. So where are you having sex? And they told me that it was in the gardens where they grew their sweet potatoes, because that was neutral territory. So late afternoon, a husband and a wife would find some private time in the garden.
Wow.
Well,
so
But
everybody
it
had their
did
own
keep
garden.
them from having much of the co-wife conflict I saw in Africa, because nobody spent the night with a spouse.
So they didn't have to bargain for whose turn it was or any of that kind of thing.
No,
That's another biblical
nothing like
story.
that.
So, you know, I'm curious because I'm a couples therapist. The vast majority of folks I work with are in monogamous, or at least striving to be in monogamous relationships. You know, I'm thinking, I don't know that much about anthropology. I'm, you know, not in your field, but I've read Helen Fisher. And
Oh,
so, you know,
sure.
I'm thinking about the notion of, you know, serial monogamy with clandestine adultery being sort of the
The
general,
standard,
the standard
yeah.
human practice in cross cultures. And that's what I encounter with folks. Anyway, I'm just curious, what can someone like me, a couples therapist who works mostly with monogamous folks, learn from the work you've done about polygamy and polyamory? And, you know, I
Yeah.
realize that's a
Well,
very general
yeah,
question.
that's a great question. And I have very much considered that. So basically, when polyamorous folks meet a new person, they, and if they really like that person, they go into a state which the Pali people call NRE or new relationship energy. And that's like akin to the attraction phase of romantic love. So where you're going to have high levels of dopamine and norepinephrine, and you really want to be just with that person.
Or limerence,
Now,
that would be the like the limerence state, more
the
like.
limerence stage, exactly. So what I started trying to make sense of in terms of polyamory is the why people would engage in the limerence phase and not want to just do it 100%, and why they would want to even keep their other partners, because the limerence phase is so delicious. But the poly people have this sort of higher level of belief in terms of what it takes to have a well-balanced brain. And ultimately, you need everything. You need the comfort and security of the attachment phase of, where there's vasopressin and oxytocin, and you're calm and at peace with your partner.
Yeah, my favorite way of describing that is I talk about you need both stability and intimacy in any relationship. And so, yeah, that NRE, it's funny, one of the things interesting about polyamory when we've talked to folks involved in that, and I think Kathy Slaughter, we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, mentioned this. People in polyamory tend to be more sort of philosophically oriented than the general population. And they come up with things. I just was thinking this as you said it now. They come up with acronyms for things that most of us wouldn't come up with acronyms for. If I have to describe my falling in love with an acronym, I know that there's an awful lot of left brain going on here. NRE, new relationship energy, as opposed to whoa, head over heels,
Exactly. So I was, basically coming up with this theory that the benefit really of polyamory was having access to both simultaneously. Because typically, if you're in your stable monogamous marriage, you've been through the attraction phase or the limerence phase, you have little access to more of that. You have sweetness and continuity and deep love, but it's very, very hard to kick up hot, intense passion a second time around. And I know
Well,
a couple of therapists, try to make a living trying to help people kick it up, and
we do, and it's fascinating because I hear what you're saying. There's a sense for a lot of couples that it seems like it's impossible. And there's the approach that says, well, not if you're continually renewing. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of continually renewing a relationship. But even that can get tiresome if it, the folks who are saying, well, we have to like just keep continually finding new ways of having sex or new kinks to investigate or things like that. There's a middle ground in there somewhere, I like to think, or maybe I should say we like to think, there's a middle ground in there somewhere where the passion can absolutely be present in this interesting tension between stability and intimacy. The place where the polyamorous stuff often fails, and of course, I often tell people, I'm an old statistician, so I think like an old statistician, I have a biased sample. I don't have I don't have a random
No,
sample of folks.
you have a sample of people who are struggling.
Exactly. Nobody ever makes an appointment with me just to tell me how well it's going. So when I hear about polyamory, it's because it's a shit show. I don't get to hear about it when it's going well, because what do they need E for if it's going well, So I
Of
do hear
course.
about it, but it's often like, well, we tried to open the relationship, and what happens, of course, is the jealousy thing. And for a lot of folks who are oriented toward monogamy, the very fact of someone else having that new relationship energy towards someone else is massively destabilizing. It messes up with that nice sense of stability.
Absolutely,
So,
absolutely.
and I know that's the challenge
Yeah,
for polyamory.
unless they completely take on the cultural belief of compersion and be excited about the excitement for their partner and feel that if that partner is accessing ecstasy with somebody else, it's a wonderful thing. And ideally that ecstatic state would be brought home and shared.
Yeah, and that's a lovely ideal. And I guess, you know, there are lots of folks who are very far from being able to imagine that ideal. And then the other piece of it is that sense that you were describing that, well, if you don't have that kind of ideal, you're never going to experience that kind of energy with a monogamous partner. And that's the part I'm saying, no, that isn't true either. Do you know what I mean? There are folks who actually do experience that in a monogamous relationship. And but again, I'm not trying to say so therefore they shouldn't be people shouldn't attend polyamory.
Right. Oh, of course I should attempt
Yeah.
monogamy. I'm not against that. No, I
Yeah.
did hear this statistic, and you might know more about it than I do, that the Masters and Johnson Institute, you know, who works with couples with these kinds of issues of lack of passion, et cetera, after, following a year of treatment, only 15% still, felt that there was an ongoing improvement.
Interesting.
It's just a really hard thing because of our romantic love brain chemistry. And that's the main reason I would endorse polyamory, if you can stomach the beliefs, is that you have the possibility of a well-rounded brain of both stability and excitement.
Now the, you know, an alternative yet again, which some folks will talk about, which is not at all, this isn't inconsistent with polyamory or monogamy, is Tantra. You know, that notion of exploring that sense within yourself of the masculine and feminine, and then, you know, letting that
Sure.
energy
And
emanate
along
between
with
people.
that is solo polyamory.
I'm curious what
Well,
that
talking about new terms.
Yeah.
Solo polyamory is often associated with another term, which is relationship anarchy.
Oh yeah, that's yeah, Kathy mentioned that one. Yeah,
Right.
I have heard that one.
So why
And
don't
so
you tell us? Basically, solo folks don't have the goal of living or being primarily partnered with anyone other than themselves, but they're nonetheless are transparent about their engagements with multiple partners.
No, I did. Yeah, I did hear that one. I also learned from Kathy, learned the term metamour, which I just find is a
Oh
wonderful
yeah,
term. Such a
having
great term.
a relationship with your partner's other partner. Right.
I was comparing that to the Yiddish word mechitten, you know, to mechitonim are your in-laws. You know, it's not this exactly the same as in English. So that, you know, my son's wife's parents are my
Right,
mechitonim. Yeah.
and
And
in anthropology, it would
yeah.
just be a co-wife
A co-wife, yeah.
or a sister wife or something like that.
So the name of your book is 177 Lovers and Counting. So keeping a little
How did
map.
I come up with that title? Well, if
I'm
you
trying to
know
see the little
anything
ticks on your
about
headboard over there.
yeah, right. Well, I kind of counted a bit, but what had happened was I retired from being a college professor in 2018. The cell phones won. People were just could not keep their heads out of their phones and could barely track a lecture. And if I screened a film longer than 20 minutes, they couldn't stay awake. They just needed so much engagement, which was them and their phone, and the dopamine hits they got when their Snapchat popped or whatever. So I decided that I'd taught long enough, and I would try to have a life outside of teaching. So I, was doing counseling, and I had this book brewing on the back of my back burner of my laptop, and I figured I should join a writing group. And so I had all the time in the world to do a daytime writing group. And this was pre-pandemic 2018, so we met in person. And it turned out that the folks in the group were a hair older than me and had grown up very differently. One member had been in an arranged marriage. Somebody else had married her high school sweetheart. They just didn't have that anthropological adventurous spirit that I took to sexual exploration. And they were constantly rolling their eyes at my stories and essays. And I thought, you know, they probably just want to hear a number. And so I created that number and titled the essay 177 Lovers and Counting. Mm. And soon after, the leader asked me to leave the group because she said I was being too provocative and that I wasn't really looking for writing assistance. I was just trying to entertain everybody, which might have been true.
What's wrong with that?
But why pay for a group to be entertained, to entertain at? So I left, and then I decided I liked the title. And when I sold it to Roman and Littlefield, they never questioned the title. They just thought it was great.
So when you were living amongst these tribes, or different groups of people, were you participating in their sexual lives as well?
Not really. No, it's, you gotta, well, so let's see. I'm like in a Mexican village. I'm like 22. All the main question I was getting asked is, ¿Por qué no estás casada? Why aren't you married? You know, and why, how did you get to come here without your parents? You're not escorted and you're of the age where you should be married. And so there, I think in one village, they told me that there was this guy there who liked me and that I could marry him if I wanted to. But that's, I basically told them I had a boyfriend at home. And
so you weren't doing it more.
I didn't think it was appropriate, you know, and it was like sort of similar to, you know, what you do as a therapist. You don't socialize with your clients. You give them space. And, you know, as an anthropologist, I, especially as a young one at that time, I was lonely and I needed friendship. And so I confided a lot in them, but I also really drew the line in terms of that, of not, you know, engaging anybody in the village romantically, nor did it even feel interesting. It was, that was something at the time I was mostly doing in the cities or the tourist spots, because the guys that were there were, you know, more worldly. And I know in Africa, at one point, some man that I was chatting with, like, assessed me and said, you know, I'd like to marry you because, you know, we could really use the money you would bring in as a teacher and as a writer, because we don't have a lot of money in our family. So, and it wasn't like, I think we have good chemistry or that we would have an amazing time together. It was extremely practical. It's like, you are a source of resources, and it would really help our family if you were part of our family.
Interesting. A very different way of looking at things.
And in India, I, you know, was largely consulted by women who were curious about love marriage. Because at the time, and I was there in 2007, there was a huge bit interest that was just starting to percolate through the media in the possibility of love marriage instead of arranged marriage. And ultimately, I wrote a whole chapter in my book about this conundrum, because the truth is what India is going through in one generation, my family went through in three generations. My grandparents were introduced by a matchmaker. It was an arranged marriage. And then my parents met at a dance, were hugely attracted to each other, and theirs was very much of a love marriage. And then I got so overwhelmed by possibilities that I just got to float around and try out everything. And that's what, you know, is going on in India, is there's a lot of young folks that, who are, you know, not sure what they want to do, because they, you know, they kind of feel that arranged marriages really limited, and whoever their parents might find for them is based on such practical things like caste and profession and, connections and resources. And
Gotcha.
they want something that sparkles more. And then they're when they try to do that, they find that the people they're meeting are not trustworthy or not as stable and reliable as, they would have expected for a spouse. And so they end up floating around a lot, as I have, not, really having, any particular structure anymore that they would trust.
Well, how can people get in touch with you and get a hold of your book and
Oh,
telephone?
well, I have a
What should we put in the
website.
notes?
My website is called Wise Woman Sex and Relationship Consulting.com. And my book is called 177 Lovers and Counting, My Life as a Sex Researcher. The book is available on Amazon. It's available through my publisher, Roman and Littlefield. It's basically available everywhere. I Googled it and I found it at Walmart, and any number of vendors have it.
Well,
Excellent.
great. Well,
And it's
thank you.
available as an ebook and as a hardcover and as a soft cover.
Oh, great.
And if you're an anthropology student, your professor might assign it next semester.
Ah,
There you go.
neat.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah,
You're
thank you for
welcome.
doing this.
It was really fun. Thank you.
Welcome back. We hope you have learned as much from Leanna as we have and enjoyed that interview.
We did enjoy that interview
Yes,
and
and if you enjoyed
really.
that interview, we hope you tell your friends about it and share our podcast and like us and follow us and do all those things one does to get the word out that there's a great podcast going on.
There is. And if you want to tell people where to go for that it is our website is ctin7.com. That's seven, the number seven, the numeral seven. ctin7.com for couples therapy in seven words. ctin7.com. If you go there, you'll have access to all of our past episodes and our merch, which we have. Just check it out. You got to check out our
Gotta check
store.
out the merch.
And of course, don't forget the books that I've written and that our good friend Larry Zilber, namely Judy, wrote a beautiful book of erotica, The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible. So until next time,
Remember, be kind
don't panic.
and have faith.